Speaker Joe P. from Columbia, South Carolina. Within the last year, Joe has given up a very successful career to devote full-time work with a suffering alcoholic. I heard him give the first talk that he made in a meeting like this about a year ago at the Allentown Roundup. His talk last year was very spiritually inspiring, and I'm sure that those of us here this morning will have that same feeling that we had in that meeting last year. So won't you please help me give a welcome to Joe P. from Columbia, South Carolina.
Hi, everybody. My name is Joe Petty, and I'm a gratefully recovering alcoholic. Spent 27 years in front of these things, but in a meeting like this, it scares me to death. I guess that any speaker at an AA meeting is nervous, because it's such an onerous responsibility. I sat where you have sat so many times as a member of Alcoholic Anonymous. I've sat around the tables of AA meetings. And I'm firmly convinced that is how God has spoke to me in my life. He has spoke to me through others. And perhaps God will use me as an instrument today to speak to somebody in this room. Perhaps I can say something about my own life. It can help you to a better way of sobriety. My story is not one that I am proud of, but I'm proud that I'm being able to tell it, because for a long time I never admitted this story. I never even admitted it to myself. It's not a story that is dramatic, but I think it's a story that's representative of so many of us that are alcoholics. I was born in 1925 in Worcester, Massachusetts. Before you take out your calculators, I'm 55 years old. I was born the son of Irish immigrant parents, a mother that couldn't read and write, and I was embarrassed about that. I grew up in a Protestant neighborhood, and I was a Catholic, and I was ashamed of that. Because back in those days, in state old Massachusetts, they used to advertise in the paper for school teachers. And they'd say, school teachers wanted, Irish Catholics need not apply. I didn't want to be one. But yet I was very, very true to my church in those days, because my family was. And as the only boy with three sisters, I became very spoiled. And even at that early age, I had serious character defects. I always wanted to be something that I was not. And priests received a lot of respect. My mother used to think that if she touched their cassock, that she'd be all right. So I decided I'd become a priest. And I entered the Jesuit order. And there for 9 years, I studied to become a priest. My motives were never good. I loved God. I wanted to be one of his followers. But I always had in the back of my mind that I can receive a lot of respect if I wear that collar backwards. And I wore it for a few years. And I'd been taught during those formative years that I was going to have to live in the world. But I couldn't become a part of that world. When I was sent out to teach at Fairfield University in Connecticut, I was assigned the task of being dean of men. And I taught Latin, I taught Greek. In a very short time, I forgot the lessons that I had learned The material started to take over the spiritual. I noticed people my own age driving nice-looking automobiles. They had pretty wives and they had little children. They lived in nice homes. And I asked to be dispensed from my vows. And I ran from that life. And I ran to New York City. With $100 in my pocket on a hot, sweltering day like this one, I remember riding to the Bronx in a subway. And I took off that collar and I put my shirt on the outside of my coat and I hid that collar behind an elevated fan. And I was alone in that asphalt jungle, not knowing how to put the money in a subway station, not knowing how to drive a car, with a tremendous education, but not knowing how to apply for the gas bill or how to pay the light bill. And it was this condition I walked into a recruiting office and joined the 82nd Airborne. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that's one hell of a transition. Somehow they ask for sugar differently in the Airborne. And they'd ask to pass it, and they'd use all those adjectives I used to break out in goose flesh. I used to tell people that I rose to the rank of major. And I told that story over and over again when I got out, and that I made 74 jumps and 3 in career. The truth is, I made 14, I was never rose above the rank of a corporal, and I never left Fort Benning. And the Airborne got mighty rough. And all of a sudden remembered I had fallen arches, and I reminded them of that, and I got a medical discharge, so I ran from that. But while I was at Fort Benning, I took one trip too often to Macon, Georgia. I went with a girl 6 weeks. She scared me to death. It was my first encounter with a woman. And I married her in 6 weeks. We remained married for 25 years. I got out of the Army, and I went into the radio and television business. My first job was doing the 11 o'clock news on radio in Massachusetts and doing play-by-play for Holy Cross College. And I loved that life. I loved the life of being a big shot. And I started a habit that was going to stay with me for a long, long time. At 11:30, when I got out of work at night, I went by the local pub. And I sat there until 3 o'clock in the morning, and I loved every minute of it. I loved to sit there with the same guys every night and tell war stories. I used to love to tell them about my great exploits as an athlete. I never quite made it as an athlete. And we lied, and we spit on each other, and we went home. And I'd look in the mirror, and I'd say, I'm never going to do it again. I'd find myself right back there the next night, and I'd tell myself I was there for the companionship. Then I began to look forward to that happy hour, or many hours. And all this time, the children were coming into our lives. 5 boys and a girl. You see, those things happen when Irish Catholics marry passionate Protestants. Life was treating me pretty well professionally, but I knew I was having a problem. I couldn't stop drinking. So like so many of you in this room, I decided it was those friends that were sitting with me that were leading me astray. So I answered an ad and I went to work in Savannah, Georgia. It's been good to see so many of you from Savannah. It's been a long time. And I took a job as news director at Channel 3 in Savannah. And I stayed there 10 years. And there I went through the phases of alcoholism. When I got to Savannah, I met the same kind of people at Tybee Beach that I left in Massachusetts. They had places that stayed open until 3 o'clock. And the very first night I was there, I was in that place. But I had a new audience. And I could dominate this new audience. And I could lie to them. Raise my rank from the army. Tell them about my master's degree. And I didn't have a master's degree. I have taken jobs in which I have filled out master's degree, and I've never been caught. I never got a master's degree. And now I had it made because I was on television. And I loved being on television because people knew me. And I loved it when people came up to me on the street. I needed you. I needed that. But the drinking increased, and the love of family was decreasing. You see, I was a well-educated man, but I never learned how to become a father. I never learned how to become a husband. I did not know how to cope with a family that size or any size. So I stayed away as much as I could. And I spent all my time seeking the approbation and the acclamation from the man on the street. I knew I couldn't get acclamation and approbation at home because they knew me. So I went on trying to be that something that I was not. And alcohol became a serious problem for me. I began to look forward at work. And about this time, the real hypocrisy started to creep in. I would wake up in the morning with the shakes. And if I am a good Christian man, I can't go on television shaking. So I found a good doctor who understood me, and he introduced me to those tiny little yellow pills called Valium. And I love them. They did for me. No one else had done for me. They stopped the shakes. So I drank my vodka until 3 o'clock in the morning. At 10 I would rise, I would take my Valium. Then I found another little pill called Darvon. And about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd take a Darvon because that would make me feel euphoric. And I'd go on the air, and I thought no one knew. Now, I can honestly say that in 27 years, I never took a drink of alcohol before going on air. And I don't say that out of pride. I say that because I knew that if I did, the phony would be all washed up. So it got to me, and my nerves got to me, and the pressures were tough, and I was rationalizing why I could drink. I made another geographic cure, and I went to Columbia, South Carolina. And I promised myself that I'd drink only on weekends. And that lasted about 2 days. And I just couldn't stop drinking. Things rolled along. The Valium increased. The doctor told me to take 5 milligrams. I was taking 20 and 30. I became so addictive to Valium that if I visited your home, I went through your medicine chest. I'm sure I ate some of your birth control pills. But all this time, my values absolutely were torn asunder. The only reason I lived any kind of a moral existence at all was that I had to be socially acceptable to the people I was serving. So my motivation was be just as good as people think you are. My family at this time knew exactly what I was, and they had long since cut me off. There was a wall built around myself and that family. It was come home late at night, do my own thing during the day, completely selfish, completely self-centered. I didn't care anything about these children. I took care of them materially because it would look bad if I didn't. I cut my grass because it would look bad if I didn't. It was nothing for me to stand in a church on Sunday in front of a men's group and give a talk on Christian family traditions and then go home and break up the furniture. I recall my youngster falling off a horse and the horse lying on top of him and him writhing in pain. And as I went to help that youngster, I remember the first thought that came to my mind, and this is how sick I was. And the thought was, how much is this going to cost me? All I needed was my face on television, my booze and my pills, and I was absolutely self-sufficient. But I was also very, very miserable. I was going through that horrible feeling that you've all experienced, that he's having a good time. But I wasn't having a good time. I was sick, and I was miserable. And that family got sick of me, and they moved to Walterboro, South Carolina. We did it on the basis of economic stability, where she was a professional. And I used to come home every weekend, and like the prodigal son, I'd drive up, expecting the red carpet. And the kids would come out and say, hi, Dad. And I'd say, why the hell haven't you emptied the garbage? Why haven't you cut the grass? Never a word of kindness. Never a word of encouragement. So finally, in Columbia, South Carolina, with the family living in Walterboro, one night a young man came to the door and he handed me a blue piece of paper. And on that paper, it said my presence was no longer needed in Walterboro, South Carolina. I added nothing to the peace and harmony of that home. And if I wanted to see these children, I had to make arrangements with the court. After 25 years of married life, they had me, and I was being divorced. And I remember taking that paper and throwing it on the ground and saying, what a bunch of lies. I've done so much for this family. I provided everything they've needed materially. And it wasn't until I took my fourth step that I read that fourth step and read the charges on that divorce. And they were very, very similar. But having got this paper, I said, I'll move out of this crummy place I'm living in. I'll go to the nicest place in town. So I went to Middleborough Apartments, 14 stories high. It had a doorman. It had a beautiful cocktail lounge. They played poker all night. They were all hundreds of successfully divorced people like me. And that's when I hit my Waterloo. It was a beautiful apartment and a beautiful apartment house. But after I sobered up, I compared that apartment house to me. It looked good on the outside. Gave a good impression. But inside my apartment was just like the insides of me, a snow-covered dunghill. Here I was, 49 years old at the time, the voice of the University of South Carolina Gamecocks, a man that had been shaking hands with President Ford not too many years before, covering things in Washington. Knew everybody in South Carolina. But inside that apartment, I had a refrigerator. Inside was a half a pound of mold and hot dogs, some sour milk, and a pint of vodka. 4 pieces of furniture from Metrolease. And a car that belonged to the company. And I was completely alone. And by this time, the sun was finding me in my soft chair in the early hours of the morning. And I was telling him, I'll get back at them. And on Christmas Day, I tried to overdose. But I didn't have enough fortitude to do that. And during this time, I met a very wonderful lady that lived in that apartment house. And she was my refuge, my island, because I went there every night and I talked to this woman. And I used to drink, sometimes a quart of liquor. And she never drank. And she'd sit there and she'd listen. And I thought she was so beautiful. Then one night, she called me about a year later at 2 o'clock in the morning. She told me to come help her because she hadn't told me, but she was an alcoholic and she had just taken a drink. I went by to see that woman and she looked like she'd been stung by a bee. Absolutely allergic to alcohol, she changed appearance. And the next day, two women came by to see her. And I thought they were some kind of holy rollers. But they put it to us fast and straight. They said, you've been a member of AA for almost a year now. Nobody poured that liquor down your throat. And they told her all about their own experiences, and they made me so nervous I went to the kitchen and drank a half a pint of vodka. A 12-step call was being made on somebody else, but it was having a bad effect on me. And this woman continued to drink, and I couldn't take that. So I told her that it was all over. I couldn't see her anymore. And all the time I was dating Margaret, my present wife. And the next day I was going to the bank with a check. I was on my way to Omaha, Nebraska to do the College World Series. And a doctor's wife came up to me in the bank and she said, Joe, I'm very sorry about Ann. I said, what's wrong with Ann? She said, Ann died last night. You see, Ann was taking antabuse. And Ann drank on top of the antabuse. She had a bad reaction. She couldn't get help and she died. And that was the worst experience I had had with alcohol. And I went to Omaha. I didn't even go to the funeral. And I smiled through 4 ball games out there. On the inside, I was absolutely dying. And in between games, after the game was over at night, I drank. I came back to Columbia early on a Sunday morning, and I hadn't shaved. I drank heavily on that plane. And Margaret was waiting for me at the airport. We went off to Savannah, to Tybee Beach. And I was about more intoxicated then than ever been in my life. And we decided we'd get married. So we went across the river to Ridgeland and got a license. And on Saturday morning, I showed up there in the Ridgeland County Courthouse. Absolutely inebriated. I had hit the absolute bottom. I really belong there. There are all kinds of successful people in that corridor. Big old stout 60-year-old women with 30-year-old guys. 30-year-old guys with other guys. And I was there. I was intoxicated. And I said, what the hell? And I put my hand in the Bible and I got married. Well, I was fine until I started back to Columbia and I began to sober up. I got to talk to Margaret. We got to talk about some personal things in our lives, like that I had 6 children. And so I put the question to her, how many have you got? And she said, 5. That makes 11, but I was still winning because I said, hell, this is a beautiful car she has. I know she's got a beautiful home. And I can put up with those 5 kids. At least I'm out of the rain. So we drove to Columbia and we announced to her 5 children that we were married. Then there was a series of events that I'll never forget. Her former husband came by that afternoon. He informed me that that house was not hers, that it was his, and when she remarried, she lost possession. And as he left, he drove the car out of the yard because he was in the automobile business. Well, Margaret doesn't mind me saying this, and maybe you've surmised it already, but she's also an alcoholic. And then started a series of bouts that were unparalleled. I moved out of that house 3 times in 5 weeks. Back to the apartment, then she'd get my clothes and move them back to the house. So finally we moved. We got our own house, and I was about to have this abortion of a marriage annulled. And Margaret said, "I have tried Alcoholic Anonymous. Let's both try it." And I said, "Well, what's it like?" She said, "Well, you take 12 steps and then you're okay." I said, "Well, you go take those 12 steps, and if you get okay, I might give it a try." But we went on Sunday morning, and I wore my sunglasses because I was a TV star in that town, and I didn't want anybody to see me sober. We went to the club in Columbia on a Sunday morning, and they were having a discussion meeting. And I was very foggy, but I really liked what I saw. I saw guys there that I thought had died. Been years since I had seen them. But there was some love there. And Margaret stood up and took a white chip. And they gave her such a round of applause that I stood up and took one too. But that night we went to Camden. They have a little club in Camden under the water tower. And I heard a lawyer speak that night, just like I'm speaking to you, and he told my story about his life and how alcohol had affected his life, how bills had affected his life. And I went home that night, and I picked up the big book, and I was a man starved for what you have to offer. And that was 3 years ago, August the 8th. And I loved this program of Alcoholic Anonymous, and I became very, very involved in it. It became my whole life. And I knew that if I wanted to stay sober, I had to change. And you told me that I had to change. Dr. Jung calls it a psychic change. My life had been motivated on sex, social acceptability, and security. And through the steps of Alcoholic Anonymous, I had to change from a selfish, self-centered man that thought only of himself to one that would put God first and you second. And Lord, that change is painful. I hurt. I suffered. I'm not up here to preach at you, but I got to tell you what happened to me. I thought I did something wrong in AA. It bothered me that I was doing something wrong because so many people would stand at the rostrum and say, "Life was so beautiful in AA, they didn't have any troubles. Hell, I never had troubles till I sobered up." I was full of fear, full of anxiety, scared to death. But I anesthetized every one of those character defects for 25, 27 years. And then when I came off the booze and off the pills, I stood naked with the same character defects that I had that I'd been covering up with alcohol. And I hated myself. And the conflicts were unreal. This young man that had been 9 years a Jesuit all of a sudden had to battle the guilt of the Catholic Church because I was a divorced man and I was remarried. And I had that feeling again that God was waiting for me to sin and snuff me out at a railroad track. I'd been so brutal to my own children. Now I had 5 more. How could I be good to these children? I weren't good to my own. My own weren't speaking to me. They despised me. They despised me for marrying again. They always thought this thing back home was going to be patched up. And I became the most insecure man that ever walked. It was easy for me to say I was powerless over alcohol. But to ask a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity was tough. But the thing that made my life the same as it did Don, was the third step. This will of mine, this was the thing that made me so different. This self-sufficiency. And I thought about this will. And God brought to me the revelation that I, made to the image and likeness of God, was stronger than the ocean, stronger than the mountains. Because the ocean ebbs and flows twice a day, right in perfect harmony in time. God's creation is all perfect harmony. The sun just the right million miles so that I don't burn up. I don't freeze to death. The trees losing their leaves in the fall and budding again in the springtime. And I thought about me. I was out of harmony with all this creation. And why was I out of harmony? Because I was out of harmony with God. Could you imagine if the ocean had a will like Joe Petty? At high tide it might say at Charleston, I think I'll go to Spartanburg. Could you imagine God's creation with free will? So this will, the most beautiful gift that God has given me, the right to say yes, the right to say no. And you asked me to take this will and turn it over to God. And I made that decision. And that was the first phase of change. But the anxieties were still there. A terrible time adjusting to a new marriage. The horrible guilt. The fear. The lack of faith. Is there a God or isn't there a God? Guilt about the past. Worry about the future. And I sat there absolutely immobile in the presence. Giving up booze and pills was rough. But making the change so that I could stay away is not an easy job. And I don't say that to any newcomer to discourage you, because it certainly is worthwhile. But as far as I am concerned, giving up the chemicals in my life was very, very necessary. But anyone who stops there is going to be absolutely miserable, if you're anything like me. I made that searching and fearless moral inventory of my life. And I told another. And I wanted God to remove my shortcomings. I want to be a good person. I have that sincere desire. I needed a lot of humility, because I'm a proud man. I have a tremendous ego. And you asked me, said humbly, asked him to remove my shortcomings. And I wanted to get closer to God, but I just didn't know how. So I listened to you, and I saw the way you did it, and I tried to walk the way you walked. And I studied this program of Alcoholic Anonymous, and I studied it, and I studied it, and I stood before you time after time and told my story. But it wasn't doing much for me, for finally my sponsor said to me, he said, "For God's sakes, you know more about the program than any man I ever know. Why the hell don't you live it?" And that was my problem. You can't intellectualize this program only. You have to walk it. You have to live it. And it's not a bad sacrifice. What are we sacrificing? Headaches holding the toilet bowl? Imperfections? Misery? Unhappiness? To walk with God. And I think I'm making such a sacrifice. And I've never been happier in my life than I am right now. Fulfillment to me for 27 years in the public eye was having a nice car and a trunk full of booze and a blonde and a weekend at Hilton Head. And I'd drive back up I-26 with the booze gone, the master charge overcharged, the blonde looking horrible, and the car breaking down. And I finally found fulfillment in the very thing that I was criticizing all my life, what I called the hypocrisy of churchgoers. It made me look so much better to criticize those that went to church. And I absolutely have found fulfillment. After doing a ball game on a Saturday afternoon, to get in my car, go to a Covetous supper in the basement of a Methodist church to an AA meeting. That's fulfillment. This is fulfillment. This beautiful weekend. The love that's been demonstrated here. I'm sorry I'm not at the point that I can't love back because I'm not that well. I'm still having trouble with that. I'm learning how to love myself. And I'm already learning how to love those kids just a little bit. But I haven't extended myself that much. Gracie told me at Denny yesterday, don't be afraid of love. We aren't going to hurt you. And I guess that's what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid to reach out. But things have changed in my life. I love the program of Alcoholic Anonymous. It's been the greatest thing that's ever happened. Theology did not lead me to God. The program of Alcoholic Anonymous led me to God. I had to make a vital change in my life. I could no longer seek the adulation of the public. So I retired from the profession of being a sportscaster. And now I devote myself working with people just like myself. And I love those people. And I'm happy. And God has a new meaning for me today. He's a God of understanding. A God that's not waiting to snuff out my life when I do something wrong. A God that loves me. A God that's become real in the program of Alcoholic Anonymous. I didn't see the miracle of the loaves and fishes, I believe it. But I see the miracles in this room this morning. And God, you're beautiful. You're made to the image and likeness of God. I see God in your eyes. I see God in your face. God is love. You people are love. You're a part of God. I'm happy today that I'm an alcoholic and drug addict.